Welcome to the second session of our conference today, a turning point in China's development. I think recently China's economy has been slightly overlooked by international watchers compared to Europe's economic turmoil, elections, and dissolved governments. China seems stable. A slowdown is obvious in the first quarter. Current account surplus is reduced significantly, and inflation is increasing, but well within control. Of course, changes in China's economy pale in comparison with the political drama at home. What has been described as China's biggest risk, the real estate bubble, hasn't had its day of reckoning. Although the gigantic bubble remains, Chinese government is pushing hard for social housing, and the domestic demand remains stable. Overall, macroeconomic policy has protected growth but avoided another big stimulus package. But behind the seemingly stable facade, there are reasons for deep concern and reasons for excitement, too. We are indeed at a turning point. Some policies with long-term impacts are brewing. Just to name a few, like the Wenzhou Financial Pilot Program, the expansion of RMB trading ban, and the increasing costs for liberalization of interest rates. Look beyond the border. There are external demand shocks and external competition increase due to the rising labor cost. China's economic development in the past three decades was primarily driven by economic reforms, the open-up policy, globalization, and the demographic dividends. Today, the effect of the last two factors is getting weaker. China needs more reforms to promote productivity growth. In that sense, the country's economy is at a crossroad. We are privileged to have a distinguished group sharing with us their perspectives from both industry and academia. They are Dr. Wang Tao, China Chief Economist, UBS Securities. Barry Naughton, Professor of Chinese Economy and So Wak Chair of Chinese International Affairs at University of California, San Diego. And Zhang Lanlan, Managing Director of CICC U.S. Securities. They're going to talk one by one and we'll start our discussion later. Thank you.
Thank you, Shuli, and good afternoon. I'd like to thank Brookings and Caixin to invite me here to share my view and also actually give me a chance to listen to the distinguished speakers and also audience. In the first panel, we talked a lot about the turning point and about the challenges in China, both politically, socially, and also economically. It's okay, I can talk without the...
Okay.
Yeah. So normally, being an economist at investment bank, normally I talk about turning point for investors, so it's this quarter, next quarter, which doesn't matter, of course. That's just actually some visual aid. I think the first panel already talked a lot about the challenges, and I think the turning point that we're talking about is really the challenges that Shuli and Vikram already mentioned, which is to, in an environment where external demand is probably going to stay weak for a long time, and China is facing demographic changes, and in an environment where we have relied very much on investment for growth, how to sustain growth in the long term, in the next 5 to 10 years, and also how to make that growth shared by the wider populace to improve sort of social equality and to make that development, I would like to use the word development rather than growth, more sustainable. So it's not just about GDP at 9 or 7%, but also socially and politically make things more sustainable. And we on the economic front, before I go there, I probably just wanted to say the 2 points I wanted to share. One thing is that as an economist, I tend to think that economy is more important than politics. So please forgive me. And I do not hope for a wise and powerful politician to somehow see the greatness of change in the next 5-10 years and miraculously change things. I believe that we need to change economic incentives and the incentive structure in the economy to frame the political powers. So I think actually economic reform is more critical for political reform that is necessary, rather than political reform has to happen first, because it's very hard to ask politicians to basically give away their power voluntarily. We must use economic forces, whether it's price signals or incentive system or taxation system, to change their behavior and change the government's behavior. So this is point number one. Number two is about the priorities of reform. What are the key important things? What are the things that to break through? Normally, people talk about financial sector reform as very important. And being an economist in the financial sector, you can imagine how many times I hear that. However, I've also been an economist who worked in the IMF. And for a long time, in the IMF, it's mostly fiscal. IMF is short for it's mostly fiscal, because a lot of the structural reforms must start with fiscal. Just imagine in the U.S., you have the Fed, okay, can print money, but how difficult is it to do fiscal consolidation? But important structural reforms are in the fiscal. It's not about the Fed printing money, isn't it? So that's the same with China. So a lot of fiscal reform and public finance reform has to happen. And so that's, I probably exaggerated a bit, but there's also other reforms, including the state-owned enterprise reform, as well as factor price and market reform. So I think the second point is that it's much more important to actually get right the structural imbalances in the structural root cause in the domestic economy before we open up to subject all the forces, all the imbalances to greater volatility in the financial world. So that's the 2 point. I agree very much with Vikram in the first panel about, you know, what are the key issues that are underlying some of the structural problems and sustainability in China. It is about the role of the state. It's really, I think, in the next stage when we talk about reform, we must rethink what the state, what the government should do, and what they should do less or not do. I don't think it's really about the size of the state. I think it's really about the role of the state. So we all know, I think, that the Chinese government has very strong power, not only in directly participating in the economic activity in production, but has a very strong hand in allocating resources in terms of energy and mineral resources, land resources, and capital. And when the government does the allocation, sometimes it can be very effective, actually. It can generate spectacular growth. And we had very strong growth for 30 years. To some extent, one has to acknowledge the efficiency of the ability of the government to mobilize savings and channel that into investment, and that has generated very rapid growth. However, at a certain point, that becomes stifling for further development, and that path cannot continue because the state is not always efficient in allocating resources in the best place. And so going forward, for that to change, we think that the market has to play a bigger role. The government, of course, made some progress, but some key prices are still under the government control. So as a result, the government rations and directly use administrative measures to allocate resources. So we think, I think, an important reform is price reform, to let the energy and resource prices to reflect the scarcity in China, and to let the market forces play a bigger role in pricing capital as well. But that brings me to the second part about the state, because I actually do not believe simply liberalizing interest rate is going to do the trick. We all understand the importance of financial repression in China, which actually played a big role, as I said, in channeling, in generating very fast growth and investment. The reason that I think that interest rate liberalization probably is not, the simple answer is that we also must reform the micro entities in the economy, the state-owned enterprises, the local governments who are directly participants in the economy. They probably are not very sensitive to interest rates because they do not have hard budget constraints. And we also must continue to reform the governance of the banks and the risk control system, risk management system. I do not believe they have successfully made a big change in the way they are running after their IPO and restructuring. Of course, they have gone a long way, but just look at 2009 in the crisis. How did that 10 trillion RMB of new loans get out if they had really good risk controls? So, before we do that, I think interest rate liberalization, when the entities participate in this have not been reformed, could actually generate a lot of risk and probably credit bubble and followed by financial crisis as well. So I think the SOE reform is something that we must go forward and we must tackle, and we cannot say let's just have the prices free and everything will be fine. The reason I also say that, here is where my visual aid comes in. I just use a example of a fact that probably everybody knows, which is in China, everybody knows that consumption as a share of GDP is very low, investment as a share of GDP is very high. A common myth is that because Chinese save a lot because of our culture, because of our lack of social safety net. But I here point to you one other fact, which is that household income as a share of GDP has also not increased, has declined. And household consumption and household income actually go hand in hand. So what is the cause of that? Why is China's saving rate so high that channels investment? Most of the increase in saving in the last 15 years is actually the corporate and government saving, not so much as household saving. And the reason they are doing that is really in the model of growth, which is that China has gone through a rapid, heavy industrialization. As you know, heavy industries are very capital intensive. So we didn't really, another myth is that we grew because we had a lot of cheap labor, we manipulated exchange rate and just exported our way to growth. The truth is that we relied a lot on capital-intensive, heavy industries, and the increment of growth, it comes from there. And as the input in the production function comes a lot from capital, you can understand that the returns also goes to capital and less to labor, and hence that income in household as a share of GDP declines. So when China talks about the income distribution, it is this income distribution. It's the income distribution between labor, household, and corporate and capital that matters the most. It's not about the rich and poor. I think that belittles the structural issues that China faces. I'm not saying that that's not an issue. The income equality between rich and poor is also an issue. But in terms of the structural change, it's also here. So even though profit margins have remained relatively stable, but profit as a share of GDP just goes up because we put a lot of capital in the economy. Okay? So to change that, here comes the questions I talk about that we must do SOE reform. One important thing, of course, is that we must remove and reduce some of the subsidies on energy, on land, on resources to industry at the expense of services and household. This is number one. Number two is that the state-owned enterprises don't pay dividend to the state shareholder. Okay, so they have free capital at disposal. We talk a lot about these state-owned enterprises borrow a lot from the banks. They do, but they actually have free capital as well because the opportunity cost of the capital of retained earnings not redistributed to the household sector or the government is free. So that makes them investing in capital-intensive industries. That cycle must be broken. So that will go a long way to help actually make the saving rate comes down. Therefore, the supply of capital also come down. So under those circumstances, interest rate liberalization have a better chance of reflecting true market signals. Finally, I think I will just, I'm probably running my time a bit. About the public finance reform, which I promised, I said it's mostly about fiscal. An important reason that I believe local governments are so obsessed about growth, in addition to their measured about their GDP performance, is that in China, the taxation system is such that most local revenue, most government revenue, come from so-called indirect tax, from production. VAT tax, which is tax at production gate, at the factory gate, at the production site. Business tax and corporate profit tax. Personal income tax almost amounts to nothing, very little, right? Less than 5% of the population actually pays income tax. So local government who wants to build infrastructure or social services or grow their GDP, who wants fiscal revenue, what do? They want investment. They want industry. They would sell their land very expensively to the commercial sector and household, but they will build industrial parks for free to invite manufacturing investment. And that whole incentive structure biases them towards industry. So we must change the fiscal and taxation system so local governments are more interested in providing public service, attracting people to live there, rather than attracting business to plunder resources and just print GDP. And so another structural issues that many of you are familiar with is the social issues in the rapid urbanization in China. We have 200 plus million so-called migrant workers in China who work and live in cities but do not have access to urban public service. And there's a lot of call for hukou reform, the household registration system. But I think the essence of that hukou is access to public service. Here, when we talk about inequality of access to opportunities and to social services, including education and hospital, healthcare, and public security, this is basically a greatest inequality because we have a second-class population there that exist but are ignored by urban government, right? Some of you may know that recently Chinese government announced that we're going to do hukou reform. People get very excited. But if you actually look at the local government, what they're doing in Beijing, in Shanghai, they're trying to close down the schools. They're trying to close down the migrant schools to chase away the people there. Why? Because they don't get any tax revenue from those people. Their fiscal resources are allocated according to hukou people. They have no incentive whatsoever to attract those people to live there. The only way they see them is cheap resources. So public finance reform to shape how local governments get their resources and spend their money can help address the core issue of making this urbanization actually a true urbanization rather than urbanization of land property. So I will just stop here. Thank you very much.
So thank you. It's an enormous pleasure to be able to follow four really interesting talks that hit on many important aspects of China's economy and society today. It gives me the opportunity to sort of weave around some of the things that have been said and try and connect it in particular, add a little integument to the very contemporary situation. So the way I'd like to try and do this is argue that there are essentially three different turning points that are going on right now in China. In other words, we can think of turning points in the Chinese economy, but when we use that terminology, we're very quickly talking about three different phenomena that happen on three different time levels. So first of all, we're right now in the middle of a short-run macroeconomic turning point as essentially orthodox macroeconomic policy starts to affect the way the economy functions and the growth rate. There's second, a medium, not un-policy, but a medium-run policy turning point, because we're facing a leadership transition, and that introduces uncertainty and new possibilities into the policy framework. And third, of course, there's a very, very fundamental long-run shift in the Chinese growth model, but more importantly, in the underlying factor endowments that China faces as it develops its route to the future. And so we should be very careful, because there are symptoms of each one of these turning points that are evident to us right now, and yet no one of them is really clearly underway. No one of them is clearly consolidated and happening yet. And yet we can clearly see that each of them is on the horizon, is beginning to have an impact in the way in which the Chinese economy functions. So, look, the first one, the macroeconomic turning point. Obviously, I think most everybody knows the Chinese economy is slowing a little bit. But we should also recognize that the current slowdown is very much the intentional result of policy, a very orthodox policy in a sense, right? Tightening monetary policy in an effort to deflate bubbles that basically date back to the Chinese response to the global financial crisis at the beginning of 2009. Of course, these bubbles needed to be deflated, so the growth slowdown should essentially be seen as a good thing, because it indicates the first steps towards a healthier macroeconomic environment. But as we look at this process, we start to see right away there are many different kinds of bubbles. There's a housing bubble. There has been a housing bubble that the Chinese government has attracted a lot of attention to, and a lot of very specific tailored policy measures to try and control the housing bubble. There's a local government infrastructure, and in fact a national government infrastructure bubble that again got completely out of hand during the course of 2009-2010. And there's also a high-tech industry bubble that I'll talk about a little bit more in a second. So as Hu Shuli mentioned, there's an ongoing attempt to grapple with these bubbles. Now, first, before we look at them a little bit more carefully, let's just say, you know, how does it look so far? And what we see so far is it looks pretty good, in the sense that growth has slowed as an effort has been made to tackle these bubbles, but growth hasn't slowed so much that it looks like we're heading for a hard landing. In other words, so far we seem to be in a sustainable growth slowdown. And here's the manufacturing and non-manufacturing PMIs that give a sense of the robustness of demand. It's clearly slowed, and yet at the same time it doesn't seem to be nearing any kind of cliff. And you know, the reason for this is essentially a relatively steady disinflationary policy being run by the People's Bank of China. So we've got a little bit of disinflation. That's good. We still have significant inflation. CPI bounced up from 3.1 to 3.6% in March. So it's certainly not over. But the central bank seems to have reclaimed an authority that it lost during 2009 to set macro policy and monetary policy, and to drive that policy in the direction of a more consistent and stable economic policy. But the issue is far from over, right? because there's still an enormous volume of resources tied up in all these different kinds of bubbles. There's an enormous volume of uncompleted housing construction. There's an enormous volume of uncompleted infrastructure investment. And the government has just begun to address these issues. So, for instance, when we look at the so-called local government funding platforms, the regulatory authorities have tried to start separating them into five different categories, essentially triage, right? Which are ones that can be salvaged? Which are ones that have to be declared bankruptcy? But when we look at overall growth, as I say, the pattern is growth declining. Quarter-to-quarter growth rate in the first quarter of 2012 is about 7%. I mean, year-over-year, it's 8.1, but quarter-to-quarter, it's a little slower than that. But what we really, you know, so the question is, if these bubbles are being burst and if growth is slowing, does that mean that the economy is now reorienting towards a different basis for growth? And the answer I think we have to say is not yet, right? It's not there yet. If we look at, if we ask the question whether investment, fixed investment growth has slowed below overall GDP growth, the answer is no, it hasn't, not yet. So that raises a puzzle, right? If housing growth investment is down, which it is, if infrastructure investment is down. In fact, infrastructure investment actually dropped in the first quarter of 2012 compared to the first quarter of 2011. So what is it that's powering continued rapid investment growth and, to a certain extent, stabilizing the growth of the economy? Well, to some extent, it's that third bubble. It's the high-tech industry bubble, which continues to be a very high focus of Chinese government priority. So that while these older, if we may, forms of investment bubble in housing and infrastructure have dropped, investment in machinery, electronics, specialized machinery, all these kinds of sectors are still experiencing investment growth rates in the 20 to 30 and sometimes above growth rate. So there's a third bubble that's going on. Government-sponsored investment in high-tech industries, and especially these so-called strategic emerging industries. And I would argue that this is not a particularly healthy form of industrial development. It's not very likely to lead to an extremely innovative society. So it's a bubble that will also need to be burst and which will create problems down the line. Now, let's look at the second phase of this, the medium term. Of course, political transitions inevitably bring uncertainty. And boy, we see extra uncertainty today, especially because of Bo Xilai. And still, it's necessary to point out that the transition, I mean, the real reason why this transition introduces so many interesting new features is that it is a very much a rule-driven transition, despite Bo Xilai. As Chen Zhiwu mentioned, the fact of having term limits, age limits, these whole series of rules are creating new dynamics in the way that leaders are selected and come to power. Now, it's natural, of course, we focus on the top leadership, Xi Jinping. Of course, that's the most important. But notice that lots of changes in economic policy over the last 6 months can be closely related to the rule-driven turnover of economic bureaucrats. For instance, the new head of the China Securities Regulatory Commission, Guo Shuqing, known to be a strong reformer, has already introduced several important measures that tend to push forward the development of capital markets. On the other hand, the new head of the China Bank Regulatory Commission, perhaps less hawkish, less concerned with strict financial criteria than the outgoing head. In each of these sectors, we see important changes in policy driven by the turnover that is in turn forced by term limits and age limits. And at the top, that means we see lots of forced change coming. In particular, we outsiders tend to look at the role of Wang Qishan, who's currently a vice premier, exactly what role will he play in the next administration, or Zhou Xiaoquan, who's the head of the central bank, which means he has ministerial rank, which means he must retire when he's 65. If that rule is applied to him, he has to retire the beginning of 2013. But if he's promoted to something like a vice premier, then he wouldn't necessarily have to step down at that point, since he's a key person in both the policy and the underlying intellectual design of reforms. That's certainly an important thing to watch. Now, in the last couple of months, the atmosphere has clearly improved. Why? Well, one reason is Xi Jinping has indicated an interest in deeper economic reforms. In the party suggestions for the 12th five-year plan, there's a line in there that says we should carry out a top-level design, Ding Sheng Sheji, for deeper, broader economic reforms. And, you know, the Communist Party is a hierarchical system with lots of face-to-face and person-to-person transmission of information. So when this document was sent down from the party center to the party committees at every level, the instruction that went along with it was this line was inserted into the document by Comrade Xi Jinping. So there's a signal that the top leadership believes that, or the incoming top leadership believes that more needs to be done in terms of moving forward with economic reform. At the same time, the problems that economists have been warning about since 2009 are starting to come true. Right, the bubbles that were created starting in 2009 that finance technocrats in particular warned about, well, now the problems are sort of increasingly there for everyone to see. So top leaders can also see, yes, we responded to the crisis in ways that were perhaps necessary, but now we've got to face the facts and deal with some of the problems. And, of course, the fall of Bo Xilai opens up opportunities. Bo Xilai was a dangerous individual in part because he was so smart and charismatic, and he articulated a vision of economic and political, I don't want to call it change exactly, but it certainly was change, that was inimical to what China really needs. Right? It was exactly a package that led away from all of the necessary changes that had to be made in the economic and political system. So his fall, and more importantly his disgrace, certainly opens up new space for better policy and more effective policy. Can we be optimistic? Not yet. It's a little too early, right? We don't yet see if there's going to be enough follow-through to really create a turning point in economic policy, and we really won't see it until late 2013. Now, these kinds of relatively short-run turning points, in my mind, pale beside the really important impact of long-run turning points. Of course, there's lots of awareness that China's growth model has to change. Ambassador Zhou spoke about the fear of a middle-income trap. I agree with Professor Zhou that there probably isn't a middle-income trap that China has to fall into. But it's undeniable that Chinese growth rate will slow. It will slow whether policy is good or whether policy is bad. And the fundamental reason why the growth rate will slow is because of the underlying endowment of labor and capital, and most importantly, skilled labor in China, is changing. You know, one way that people look at it is to talk about a labor surplus, whether China used to be a labor surplus economy and is leaving that status. And the answer is yes, it clearly is. But the striking thing about China is China's going to move out of this labor surplus status extraordinarily quickly, because the normal process of economic growth is going to be reinforced with demographic factors and the rapid increase in education of young people, which means the shifts in endowments will be particularly fast. In other words, the decline in the supply of unskilled labor will be unusually rapid, while the increase in the supply of skilled labor is going to be also extremely rapid. So here's just some quick information that shows that the overall labor force is going to plateau very, very quickly within the next couple of years. But more important, at exactly the same time that the overall labor force is going to plateau for essentially demographic reasons, the share of that labor force going into college or graduating from college is continuing to explode. And therefore, just as the overall labor force plateaus, the skilled labor force continues to grow very quickly, which means the unskilled labor force, look at that, is already declining by almost 40 million workers in this decade, and in the next decade will decline by 70 million workers. So that means China's export economy is going to change. It's going to change rapidly, right? The wage pressure we're already seeing is going to continue. Again, this is not a turning point that's already happened. China's growth, China's exports of labor-intensive manufacturers continued to increase at double-digit rates in 2011, so the trade surplus hasn't gone away. But again, a third turning point that's on the horizon that faces the leadership. So in conclusion, what do we face? Two choices, one quick argument that I want to make. Two choices, will the new leadership headed by Xi Jinping really push for a revived economic reform agenda? The good news is everybody's talking about it. Everybody now recognizes for the first time that reform has gone backwards in the last 4 or 5 years, that at least we need to think about moving forward. And, of course, Vikram Nehru and the World Bank team did a superb job of pushing these issues onto the agenda for China. The second crucial choice for China is how will China opt to develop the skilled industrial sectors in which it has an increasing comparative advantage and which are needed to absorb the millions, literally millions of new college-educated workers who are pouring into the labor force. I believe that the current approach is mistaken. It's going to have to be rethought. It's going to have to be redeveloped. It's going to have to be adapted in a way that opens up the economy to much more entrepreneurial, service-oriented, and creative activity than is the case in today's government-dominated approach to high-tech industry. And then one final argument, and that is the fact that these three turning points are coinciding does create a window of opportunity for economic policymakers, because it means that a policy of conservative monetary policy combined with liberalization, standard orthodox economics, has something that we're very familiar with, that economists are very much aware of, will have better effects because it will simultaneously address all of these turning points and push them forward. Conservative monetary policy, more rapid liberalization can help China make its way through each of these turning points at the same time. Thanks.
First, I would like to thank Brookings Institution and Caixin Media for inviting me here. My background was industry analyst the time that I was with the CICC, China International Capital Corporation. So instead of talking about the macro level reform, political reform and economic reform, I'd like to focus on where we see the industry reform can take place and how is that going to improve China's productivity. Given what Ambassador Zhou just mentioned, that China is a developing country and it will take time for political and economic reform. So is there anything we can do on the industry reform side that can actually improve the productivity? My background as a telecom analyst since a decade ago shows that actually that's possible. If you look at what had happened to the China telecommunication industry since a decade ago, nobody would imagine that China could achieve what it is achieving now in the telecom industry. There was no foreign ownership in that sector, except there was a public ownership in the Hong Kong market for some of the major telecom operators. There was no private sector involvement as well. But if you look at where we are one of the we're definitely the largest wireless and telecommunications market in the world. And our operator, for example, like China Mobile, became the largest operator in the world. They have, by the market cap standard, and they have the one of the strongest balance sheet, and sometimes it's getting too worrisome that China Mobile has, you know, about 300 billion RMB in the listed company, probably another 300 billion RMB at the parent co level. And also, even if you look at the service level, the Chinese probably experience much better network coverage, much better job rate than even here in New York City. I think that's one of the things that some Chinese were complaining when they travel in this part of the world. You have signals in the subway. You have signals in the lift. So how come China can achieve that? But in the meantime, we're facing new problems and concerns in that particular sector. For example, there are corruptions. For example, we're seeing the operators are becoming a monopoly in wireless sector, in broadband sector. So reviewing, you know, what had happened in the last decade might be very helpful for us to understand how China going forward can reform some other service sectors, for example, the healthcare, for example, media sector, for example, the railway. You know, those are the sectors, given the productivity that we have seen in the telecommunication sector, if that could be achieved in those sectors, I would say in the short to medium time that China can continue its economic growth as well. It doesn't mean that I don't believe in the necessity of political reform. It doesn't mean that I, you know, we should have more reform on the ownership structure instead of having all the state-owned enterprises to dominate some very strategic sectors. But if you look at what we did right for China telecommunications sectors for the reform, first of all, we separate the regulatory function, the administrative function, from the corporate day-to-day operation functions in 1998. And I think that's a very important step so that we have a true regulator, we have a true Chinese corporate. And if you look at what we did right, secondly, even at that time, I think there was a foresight that we cannot have a monopoly in that particular sector. So the government actually try every way to segregate the companies into fixed line and wireless, and also trying to support China Unicom to become the competitive carrier. So at the very beginning, there was a mindset, even though that wasn't given to the private sectors, but there was the mindset that we have to have competition in that sector. And thirdly, I think it's very important, not just because they went public in the Hong Kong market, and then you have the international investment community to have the scrutiny on the operators, but I think very important through that listing process, there is a set of benchmark and KPIs that those state-owned enterprises will be measured, will be benchmarked, will be evaluated. And in fact, at a very early stage of the reform, there was a great of an incentive plan there to encourage the Chinese operators actually to do better. There was a revenue sharing plan at the management level, at the employee level. So that those were, I think, the right things that we did. But there are also things that if there is a lesson that we have to learn, and I think that there are also things that we missed. For example, at the very beginning, we have a very strong regulator, and that was Ministry of Postal Communication. But later on, it was changed into Ministry of Information Industry. And now it combined with all the industries, for example, steel, automobile, it become under Ministry of Industry and Information. So what's the net result of that? There was a lack of consistency in the regulation. There was a lack of adjustment to the market conditions. And as a result of that, there was a lack of, it was a result of a lack of staffing, a lack of financial support. So there is no figure or counterparty of FCC in China right now. And the result is that those companies are becoming too big, and they become such a monopoly in one particular sector. And those sectors are subsectors are big. For example, China Mobile is controlling around 70 to 80% of the market in the wireless space, and then basically China Telecom and China Unicom are very strong players controlling similar or if not higher market share in the broadband space. So you have this, because of there is a lack of antitrust law or a procedure to put a control on those areas, then what we're seeing right now in the market, there was complaint about monopoly and not enough responding to the market and to the smaller operators. And it's very interesting, actually, that at the beginning of the year, there was one case. It's actually the first case that was brought to the NDRC and the court to go against China Telecom and China Unicom for by two very small ISP providers in China. So no consistency in the regulatory function, and there was no antitrust. So as a result of that, and also in combination with what is lacking, which is the optimum capital structure, because government is the ultimate shareholder, and if government does not go out to present or control or manage an optimum capital structure, the result is that there was way too much cash piling at the corporate level. And as Mr. Chen mentioned that, and also previous speakers mentioned that the efficiency or the return of those cash flow on the balance sheet was very low. And what's getting even worse in that situation is that because there was so much cash, then there is corruption, and almost China Mobile becomes the center of many corruption cases, and senior management, quite a number of them, if not three or four, have already been put into custody. So that's a side of impact of having those pile of cash on the balance sheet. So those are the problems that we have been seeing in this privatization or reforming of that one service industry. So my conclusion is that I think there are a number of industries in China or in a similar situation. If we can have the commitment to go push forward for the separation of regulatory functions from the operational units in stimulating competition, not between the private or state at this stage, but at least among the state enterprises. There would be great potential of productivity achievement over there as well. Thank you.
Ask another. Yeah. Anyway, my question is about income distribution, because we all know that income distribution, the situation in China is really, really serious. I just heard that the new study about the Gini index like reached 2.6 already, and we know like the maximum for like for the like the conflict, the social pressure is 0.4, but now we reached to 0.6. So what is the major measure that do you recommend to resolve this problem?
Well, I think it's very, very difficult to address income distribution directly. So, I think I'm in sort of in Wong Tao's camp about how we can move forward, that it's a question of tearing down barriers that protect profitability in the corporate sector, allowing prices to rise for factors of production, including labor and land and interest rates, and that that's a good wedge to begin with. And that if we, because that's a set of policies that not only move in the right direction in terms of income distribution, because they tend to take away some of the privileges that the wealthiest take advantage of, but they also move the economy in the direction of being more fair and more flexible. So I think I'd start with that and then hope that in the longer run, improved Social Security, improved income tax systems would also take a step in the direction we'd like to go.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add to that. I agree with that. I think on China, one important thing about the income inequality is also inequality of opportunity. Children going, to school, access to higher education. I think things have actually deteriorated. When I used to go to university, we have almost half of the people coming from the countryside who are very poor. Now you go to the top universities in China, very, very few are from the countryside.
Yeah, yeah.
This is obvious. Because they don't, already from the very beginning, they don't have access to the kind of school that will enable them to go to good universities, but also job opportunity. I think more sort of equal access to opportunity, that's a long-term solution for income inequality. The second, I think also on income tax reform. Right now, the income tax is very much a salary tax that basically taxes the white-collar working class. There's no property tax, no wealth tax, no capital gains tax, no interest tax, no inheritance tax. Anything that the rich makes is not taxed at all. So it's, of course, I have a personal incentive because I'm a working person who makes a lot of people, so I probably pay half of the tax of my district. But so it's because only a few people pays, right? And most of my peers actually in Hong Kong. So I think income tax reform is very important, to put all the income there, every income together, and then significantly increase the threshold of income tax, and also the breakdown sort of the privilege of access of certain group of people to resource. A lot of the wealth were created because they have access of land, of mines that belong to the state, but they don't pay any resource tax. So these are how, it's not about people who are innovative and who have developed products. A lot of the times, I think the complaints about inequality is this unfair access to resources.
Mm-hmm. Any addition?
Yeah, I think in addition to that, I think it's also very important to get our pricing of factors right. And that's in that process is actually you have a better chance to achieve income distribution result. And also, I think it is also very important that there should be a rethinking of relationship with the society from the Chinese corporates as well, and also the rich people. There are of course be excuses that because that area is pretty dark and disruptive, so people are no longer making contributions to the charity work. But I think there should be a better way to arouse social awareness to see this is a long-term sustainable approach.
Okay.
Could I add one thing?
Yeah.
If we really are reaching this sort of turning point in labor availability, mm-hmm. then we should expect to see inequality get a little bit better mm-hmm. as the supply of unskilled labor starts to reduce a little bit. So that makes me a little bit optimistic. On the other hand, what I hear more and more from essentially middle-class people mm-hmm. who, really are pretty well off and are certainly much better off than their parents, but that they're much more concerned with the unfairness that so many opportunities are taken by a relatively small group. So rather than it being, you know, the danger of the poor being angry, it's we really see middle-class resentment growing in China, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, okay.
Judd Hiriot, documentary filmmaker. Could I get Barry Naughton to elaborate a little bit more on why he feels that the, I believe you call it the investment bubble in the high-tech, capital-intensive sector is the wrong way to go? Or maybe you could talk a little bit more about innovation in that sector. How close are they to, say, fielding world-class products from that sector, so forth and so on?
Great. That's also my question.
Okay. Well, of course, it's a huge topic. And China has remarkably creative scientists and engineers and has some really wonderful startup companies. But what we're seeing in the last couple of years is a lot of government money going top down, designated sectors, designated technologies. The strategic emerging industries cover 35 industrial sectors. And in each one of those sectors, there's a plan that's been in process, not an old style, you know, centrally plan, but over the last couple of years, drawing up as components of the 12-5-year plan, a program of what kind of technologies are going to be supported, what regulatory policies will be used to support them, and sources of money. And so, of course, people respond to those incentives. They adapt their behavior and they say, this is where the money is, this is where the opportunity is. I'll adjust whatever I was doing to become eligible for these monies, to, if I'm a local official, to set up a new industry. So I think a lot of energy, a lot of activity gets diverted into essentially, in some cases, I mean, the extreme version is sort of fake innovation, but more than that, just duplicate investment in technological paths that may or may not be successful. So, for instance, China has 8 or 10 large projects on plug-in battery cars. Okay, maybe, you know, but is that likely to succeed? How many will succeed? 1? 2? All right, so there's just a lot of overinvestment in many sectors. And I think it's going to come back and hurt China while it disrupts the markets for these crucial products.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Chen Jian. I teach finance at Johns Hopkins. My question is actually to Hu Shuli. I sometimes write for Caixin Media, so we are not strangers. But this is not a staged question. I hope it's a hardball question. So a lot of the audience of Caixin Media, they recently criticized Caixin for a lack of report on the recent very important incident. a lot of my friends, online friends, they think Caixin could be more, pushing the political and economic reform by doing more investigative reporting. So my question is, how do you position Caixin Media? Do you believe Caixin Media should be a pioneer in pushing all these reforms, or just a fair or objective observer of this incident? Thanks.
Thank you. Actually, it's not that relevant, so I give a short answer. I think Caixin has been very active and professional on investigative reports, mainly in business and the finance industry. We are not that in this the Bojia case, I understand people are so curious and everybody wants to know the fact. And we are working on something, but it's hard. We are not that. We haven't got the full picture of that. And right now, we saw only piece by piece, small piece by piece. And we hope that we can get something which is really whole story. Because I think. We got so many small pieces. It's like as a brand touching a big elephant, you see different legs, you never know what is a real elephant. We feel that way so far, and we're working. Okay, thank you. Okay.
Hello, my name is Huang Yan from the Fund as well. I want to ask my previous colleagues about what's your view, Dr. Wang Tao's view about the return of investment. Basically, we all know current account equals saving minus investment. You mentioned a lot of saving side. What's your view about return on investment? Secondly, what's your idea about, you mentioned a lot of political concern, political uncertainty, what's your view about precaution motive due to the investment side or precaution motive savings in terms of you talk about a lot of story about corporate levels. So key question, what's your view about return on investment?
Returns of investment. This being at the center of a lot of debate about whether China is a big investment bubble, whether the returns to China's investment is diminishing. I think the question actually, the answer is actually more subtle, because if you actually look at the returns, profit margins at the industrial sector, it's been very stable. So we haven't seen a lot of sort of diminishing returns. It's not true. It's not like in the late 90s where investment is just pouring into overcapacity sectors, producing things that's not for sale. I think Chinese companies have been smarter and the economy has changed, and so that's not happening. On the other hand, how do you explain the fact that, we have a lot of investment? Especially in the last few years, the last 3 years, a lot of the investment that's government-mandated, government-supported, actually went to infrastructure. So if you look at the I-Core, incremental capital output ratio, it actually is increasing. However, I think a cautious point I would point out is that infrastructure should not be, we should not judge infrastructure by returns of sort of fare, ticket fare, and so on and so forth, because it has externality. It's supposed to generate productivity for the whole economy over a 20-30 year period. So it's a little too early to say those are completely unnecessary or unproductive. I tend to believe that China still have a lot of potential to rake, returns to this infrastructure investment. But another part, of course, is in property. And I would say if for the next 10, 20 years, we'll continue to build infrastructure but not generating returns via better productivity in the manufacturing sector, then we will not be able to get those returns. So, sorry, it's not a clear answer, but basically I think that the fact that we do invest a lot means that returns are relatively low, but at the moment, you do not immediately see sort of diminishing returns, so there's still a case for more investment, but the allocation of that investment to which sectors and the pace of growth is probably debatable.
Hi, I'm Huining Cao. I'm a professor of finance in the Chiang Kong Graduate School of Business. I agree with the earlier analysis on the monopolies in China. Monopolies are kind of bad for innovation and also like it's created inefficiency in the market. So my question is, the reason why there's so many monopolies in China is because they're actually controlled by many of the princelings of the old political leaders, like Guang Er Dai. So basically, it's kind of kind of distribution of wealth kind of more to the people who have connections. If we want to have a reform, and as economists, we know that you have to satisfy the participation constraint or like the win-win kind of idea. That is, how do we can make sure these like princelings or these people in power can also benefit from reform? And that would be very hard. So I wonder, you talked a lot about antitrust law and the kind of removal of monopolies, how that can be initiated given that these people who benefit from monopolies are actually in power.
Well, yeah. Well, for the industry, I just mentioned, the telecommunications industry is actually not a result of because it's owned by Guang Er Dai or, that was the case. But I think there is a broader base lack of definition. What is antitrust in China? I think that there is a lack of functional regulatory body can dive into the research of antitrust so that how is the impact of the, innovation, how is it going to... I think there is a lack of understanding that, you know, if you encourage long-term monopoly, antitrust is actually a reduction of innovation and even an efficient allocation of resources. And I think also because China telecommunications industry is one of the first industries actually been going through industry reform, and eventually after a decade, we still start seeing, although the original intention was to introduce competition, but the ending result, because of the tech, we didn't catch the technology trend, because we were very reluctant to put a market share cap on the key industries, and then it ends up with a monopoly situation in one, two major sectors. I think this is actually a great opportunity for China to call for further reform and a further I think at the legal system level, there is a lack of a definition of what is monopoly, what kind of a market share will be defined as monopoly. And I think that needs to be addressed.
Just wanted to add a couple of things. I think one is that they're actually so even if it's Prince Ling or Guanar, that there's competing forces. Somebody is in the upstream, somebody's in the downstream. The downstream people will complain about the monopoly in the upstream. So I think natural forces in the economy will help. The second thing is, I think as the history of China's reform have shown, that we are actually pretty good in developing around it. We started the economy with much of, you know, the whole economy is state-owned, right? Instead of directly tackling the SOEs, the commanding highest industries, we let the rural sector, the FDI, the foreign sectors, and small business to flourish. And then gradually over time, SOE and the state as a share of GDP is much smaller. So I think that's also basically to allow private entrance into certain sectors. That's a way to gradually chip away at the monopoly as well.
Okay. Hi, I'm Felicia. I'm a junior at Georgetown University, interning with U.S. China Business Council. So, Professor, you talk about there are already reforms in China's capital markets, and Ms. Zhang also talked about there's already obvious development in Chinese capital market. And my question is, looking back at the financial crisis in 2009, one reason that China wasn't affected is we don't have a large range of financial products. We don't have the derivatives. And I was wondering if you could comment on what do you see of the development of financial products in China?
You should take that.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't let the financial crisis actually stifle the financial product innovation. I think China, in terms of the financial market, is way behind in terms of the products available in the market over there. For one example, like we have only cash equity in the equity business. There was a lack of derivative, and there was now we have a futures, but also there was a lack of shorting mechanism in China. So if we don't have those innovative financial products, the problem is that the Asia market cannot find the fundamental value of that market easily, because you only have one mechanism and one product. So given that, I think we should not being discouraged, which is also CSRC amazingly was not discouraged by what happened in this part of the world, introduced, and they still decide to introduce future business in China, the index future, and also I think most likely towards the end of the year there will be stock borrowing as well. So I think those are positive trends. But in the meantime, I think what is problematic in China is that we're not investing enough to build our regulatory functions. And for example, I mentioned about the telecommunication sector. And another example, in many, many other sectors that we want to go for reform, but the problem is that probably over the last 20 years, the people who have the financial resources, who were having the education, decided to work for the private sectors or decided to stay overseas. So there was obvious a regulatory function vacuum that is in China. We need to staffing properly. We need to financing those functions properly in order to be able to have the regulatory body that to avoid the problems in the future.
Okay.
For Tao and Barry, Sheldon Ray, Morgan Stanley, Smith Barney, there were reports in March of copper import increases into China up 50% over the previous year, and iron ore imports up 5-6%. Iron ore prices at like 6-month highs. Is this like a post-New Year aberration, or is the economy picking up a little more than people expect?
You work for an investor. You should answer that question.
Okay. So I started with iron ore. So in terms of iron ore and in the steel sector, basically our thesis, I didn't talk about the short term, I agree with Barry, that actually we have seen a turning point in China. The steel consumption is rising. We deduct by looking at steel production is rising, inventory is dropping, steel prices are rising. So this is an obvious indication that actually some construction is returning. That probably includes some social housing restructuring. And in the private property side, it's stabilizing. I talk a lot about property because 35 to 40% of steel in China is used in property. And it is the long products, which ray bars and so on, for construction, that is rising. It's not the sheet products. And as you know, China produces half of the iron ore and imports the other half. The other half happens to be the high-quality ones. And so the inventories, you know, have been reasonable. So as demand starts to pick up, then people start to import more. So I believe this is true demand returning. And, of course, we do have, on the supply side, we have monopoly or oligopoly that so they can control the prices, and so prices rises. Copper is a much more complicated story because copper is highly speculative. And so in the first quarter, not just March, actually demand, I mean, imports went up 50% in volume year on year. And then at the same time, in the bonded warehouses in Shanghai, the copper inventory just went like that. And now currently at historical levels. So that does not seem to mean that underlying demand is growing, but it's rather an inventory buildup, which could be speculative. So I think, you know, for me, if just I look at, I'm not a copper analyst, I'm a macro person, but people ask me questions about copper all the time. So I look at that and I say, well, I can only conclude that even if underlying demand in China picks up, whether from construction or from power and so on, I doubt that copper imports can go up much more because we already have such high inventory. So I would be quite bearish on copper price at the moment.
The back.
Zhi Wang from U.S. International Trade Commission. So I have a question for Professor Barry Norton. You mentioned that the China's have a three very important turning points, especially talking about the structure change and the endowment structure change. So about 20 decades or 20 years ago, even very few people can imagine China become a world factory, become a manufacturing center of the world. So China starting to export not only become a neither exporter, not only labor-intensive products, also or technology and capital-intensive products, or most all manufactured products. But because of the structure change going, that's have a fundamental impact on the world economy. In the next decade or 20 years, as you mentioned, China's endowment structure will be dramatic shift from unskilled labor to more and more skill-intensive. So what is that impact of where impact on China's industry upgrading and also on the rest of the world? I think that's also have a lasting impact on the other part of the world economy. I really like to hear your opinion on this. Another point is talking about China's developing of service sector, that's really important. But we have to understand for example, the business service sectors, most is served for the manufacturing sector. If you don't have a manufacturer base, how you develop, how you can develop the business service to serve for the manufacturing sector. Secondly, if you use the official Chinese statistics, I have a question, because you see China's statistical system is company-based. It's not establishment-based. So a lot of state-owned company, they have service when they place the replace the worker to a company. They do a lot of service sector stuff, but it's still China's standing agency still collect them as industry sectors. So in many people's view, China's service sector's share in GDP is underestimated. What is your opinion? Thank you.
So lots of great questions and wrapped up in that. I think it is true that China's service sector is underestimated. And thank goodness, because if it's really as low as the data say, it would be an even more distorted economy. But you know, China has a huge manufacturing sector. No matter how we look at it, the official sectors, the official data say that it's not only the largest share in the world, but it's the largest share an economy has ever had. Right. So yes, there's probably some overstatement in that, but certainly there's plenty of manufacturing there. And so when we think about the structural change, you know, what will be the impact on the global economy? Well, I wish I knew, but clearly there is a sense in which it could be a highly positive driver of global growth, right? Because China is going to move out of many labor-intensive sectors, and there are many, many economies ready and already thinking about gearing up on how to move into those sectors. So that could be highly positive. It could also be positive for the U.S. because there's still, U.S. and Germany in particular, there's still a range of very sophisticated capital equipment that will have a larger market as China moves into the middle range of commodities, both for domestic demand and for exports. And, of course, raw material suppliers would also welcome it. So, I mean, there, you know, it's possible to have a very, very optimistic story about what China's upgrading means for the global economy. And I hope we get there. I can't guarantee we will, but it could be very positive. What do you think?
Okay. Yes.
This is Wei Zai from the World Bank. I just want to ask Professor Norton about how do you evaluate the Chinese young generation of labor force? Because everybody knows there is high unemployment rate, and because of the expansion of the tertiary education in the 90s and also the single child policy, actually their reservation wage is pretty high and the kids don't really want to go to work if the wage is not high enough. So how do you evaluate this labor force, and do you think they will capable of transform China into an innovative and skilled labor intensive economy in the future? Thanks.
Well, that's well above my pay grade, as our president said before he reached the highest pay grade. But I mean, in the long term, do Chinese young people have the skills and adaptability to drive China to a much higher level of skill and capability? Of course they do. I mean, it's so obvious, right? They are so capable and so hungry in many ways. Now, of course, I'm very optimistic about what Chinese young people are capable of. Now, having said that, a lot of them, you know, we've had a very, very rapid expansion of the educational system. So most of people coming out with tertiary degrees have pretty mediocre educations at this point. I mean, obviously, there are some great universities in China, and some of them are moving towards the frontier. But the majority of these people are coming out with a, you know, relatively low quality education. They're going to need to supplement it by lots of on the job experience. They have to find work first. So there are a lot of challenges to overcome before we get there.
Ken Meyer, Court World Ducks. Dr. Tao's belief that market resource allocation is favorable to state allocation, and Dr. Zhang's talk about futures markets and derivatives and shorting the market makes me wonder whether you're advocating the introduction of American-style casino capitalism to China. Is that position, if you are, philosophical, or are there metrics by which we can measure the success of resource allocation in an economy?
It's not philosophical to start with. I think that it's all relative. I think in the U.S. you have probably gone too far with deregulation without proper supervision. Whereas in China, I think we cannot actually look at the U.S. and say that's completely wrong. We should go back to our system, which unfortunately I think is the greatest lesson Chinese policymakers may have learned, and it's the wrong lesson in my view. We are so far in still reforming the state control to say that, you know, that we shouldn't repeat the U.S. We shouldn't, but we are still a long way from repeating the U.S. I'm a great believer that the state, you know, the state should have some control, should have better supervision and regulation to sort of set up the framework where people have, you know, equal access and level playing field. Right now, actually, in a lot of part of China, it is a casino, except it's a casino for the privileged few, and not for, you know, for the people who have autonomous desire to grow. It's the people who have the control of the resources. I think that so for U.S. case, you probably need better regulation, but in the Chinese case, we need deregulation still, and we need the market to play a role, because right now the signal is not there. It's basically a government who decide, who pick winners and choose winners in industry. Barry gave example of high tech. 1 year the government decide we need to do green tech. 200 counties invest in solar power. In 2 years the capacity increases by 500 times. Okay, so this is a casino with the state control, that with the market not playing a role anymore. So I think we are coming from another spectrum.
Thank you. My name is Alicia. I come from the University of Maryland. And I want to ask questions about the China's young people, about their adaptability of the job market, because I have noticed two states that last year the Chinese youth participated in the CFA test, and about the government officials entering tests. Both these two tests, the number is historical high in the last years. So I wonder if when there's a situation that the government obsess a lot of Chinese youth to enter, and the financial market, they provide high salaries and a salary package for the youth, and all of these young people, they want to find jobs in these two areas. And so what about the another job market areas? Because I have also noticed that there's a huge shortage in the industry, especially in the labor-intense areas. So if no other intents to force the Chinese young people to participate in the other areas, I wonder that if such trend will continue and if that will harm the future of China's economy. Thank you.
So you're referring to the fact that more and more young people are taking the exam to get into the civil service? So some 500,000 young people took it last year, and then the other sector is the financial sector, because they're rational people. Right? This is where the money
and
power
is.
So I think it, in some sense it reflects well on Chinese young people, but somewhat poorly on the Chinese system, in the sense that you would hope that there would be many more sectors that offer, you know, really high potential career returns, and I think there are. And after all, 500,000 people apply for the government, but only 2% make it. So the other 495,000 are going somewhere else.
Well, yeah, I think one thing is the reform of our education system. For example, that in universities, the more students you get, the more resource you get from the Ministry of Education. And so they don't care if the students actually find jobs. So there's a disconnect between what the society, what business wants, and what the university is producing. And so the reform of that is necessary. The second thing is that I think for business, they have had very good time in just tapping into surplus labor. They didn't have to provide trainings. A lot of them don't even provide a working contract, right? You migrant workers work there for 10 months and then you go home. Next year you reapply again. But as labor becomes shorter in supply, then business feel the incentive to provide a contract and on-the-job training. They see the benefits of retaining people. I have big hope that we will be able to adapt on both sides, because economic incentives are changing.
Anyone else? Okay.
Xue Li from the science. My question is still go to the Hu Su Li. Just talk about a little case about mark rating. Because let's consider about China's context. To do the mark rating is very dangerous in China. I just wondering how do you deal with the rule? Because there is the potential boundary for you deal with these kind of articles. How do you control the things? Like the Jijin Neimu. When you decide to publish this book, what do you think about it? Is it in the boundary, not outside the boundary? Thank you.
Actually, boundaries are there in China, but the secret is never think about the boundaries. Otherwise, you will do nothing. So we just think, where is the news? And we just cover the news. And the lucky is that we saw there are more news and journalists in China. That's the luckiest part for journalists in China. Thank you. So, okay. Thank you very much. End of the conference. And so on behalf of the Brookings Institute and Cai Xin, I would like to give our sincere thanks to all the speakers who gave the remarkable talks here and gave their frank and thoughtful interactive discussion with our audience. I also want to say thank you for all the audience for your attention and for interest about the topic we gave today and also for your active discussion with our speakers. Thank you very much.
First of all, I want to add with our thanks to Caixin Media for its wonderful cooperation on this, and especially to Hu Shu Li. And I want to mention that a good part of this will be available on our website, transcript, and perhaps all the slides or most of the slides we still have to discuss with the various speakers. So be sure to come to the website after a couple of days, and you'll be able to get a good record of what you've just heard this afternoon. Again, thank you all.
Caixin's website.
Oh, and on Caixin's website, you'll have what, a video of this or transcript?
Video and a transcript and also reports tomorrow.
But and smaller reports. And so all of us are famous in China now, okay? Probably in English and Chinese or Chinese voiceover?
The transcript will be English at the same time, but afterward okay. Become Chinese later.
Bilingual on Caixin, monolingual on Brookings. And thank you all very much for coming.